From the Moan Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm Stephen Cuevas, filling in for John Horn. On today's show, Lucasfilm is now hiring for a new Star Wars filmmaker after parting ways with the team behind Game of Thrones. And then photojournalist George Rodriguez documented LA celebrity high life and social upheaval. But his career was born from pragmatism.
I needed a job. You know, I was 15 years old, and, you know, you hear your parents talking, and I just had to get out there and make a living.
And the singer who goes by the name Sansha balances the sacred and the profane. All that coming up on The Frame. Welcome to The Frame. I'm Stephen Cuevas, filling in for John Horn. Lucasfilm is now scanning the galaxy for new filmmakers to take over the next installments of its epic Star Wars franchise. Producers David Benioff and Dan Weiss parted ways with Lucasfilm this week after recently inking another production deal with Netflix. But the longtime producing partners, who also led the Game of Thrones series, were also feeling pressure from the high expectations of devoted Star Wars fans. We reached Hollywood Reporter senior editor Aaron Couch to talk through what happened.
Our reporting shows that after the backlash that these guys experienced this year to the poor reception to the Game of Thrones final season, they kind of were looking around the landscape and seeing Star Wars fans can be pretty toxic. You know, I mean, Rian Johnson, who directed The Last Jedi, has definitely bared the brunt of fan ire. And so these guys are saying, OK, we've just angered Game of Thrones fans. Do we really want to spend the next 5 to 10 years dealing with Star Wars fans now? So I think, you know, in terms of their thinking, from what we understand, there is some connection to the end of Game of Thrones and the reaction and to their decision to step back from Star Wars.
Well, it was back in early 2018 that David Benioff and Dan Weiss were hired to write and produce a new Star Wars trilogy. How far along did they get?
As far as we understand, you know, the original deal was these guys are going to write and produce a trilogy. And then it became at some point, well, they're going to at least write the first one and, you know, oversee the others as producers. As far as we know, they were working on a treatment. We don't think there was ever a script for this first film, which was supposed to come out in December 2022.
Well, this may be a dumb question if you're a fan, maybe not so much for a neophyte like me. How is this trilogy supposed to fit into the existing Star Wars universe?
The speculation was these guys will probably do something that is set in the far, far past, before Luke Skywalker, before Anakin Skywalker, Darth Vader, and kind of do something that is connected, but far enough in the past where they wouldn't have to worry too much about deep canon and things like that. I mean, The assumption was these guys, in theory, are very, very good at world building. You know, it depends on who you ask, but they took George R. R. Martin's series of books and, you know, helped create this amazing world on screen. So the thinking was these guys will go off and create their own amazing world in Star Wars. You know, but we don't really know if that would have worked. People have pointed out once they got beyond George R. R. Martin's books on Game of Thrones, the show really suffered in quality. So there are questions of, was it Martin or was it these guys that were the true geniuses, you know?
Right. Well, Benioff and Weiss claim that the reasons for exiting the project had to do with their commitments to Netflix, and they signed a $250 million deal with the streaming service in August. Netflix was apparently okay with them working on Star Wars, but how did Lucasfilm feel about that?
From what we understand, Lucasfilm was a little bit nervous because, you know, you have to keep in mind, these guys have only done Game of Thrones for the past 10 years. They're not the kind of guys that are going to be juggling a bunch of projects, or at least that hasn't been shown to be their interest or skill set. So certainly when the Netflix deal happened in August, there was some concern or at least questions in Lucasfilm. Well, wait a minute, are they really going to be able to deliver on Star Wars and this Netflix deal?
These are not the first bodies to either fall or get pushed off of the Star Wars spaceship. Numerous directors have been jettisoned over the last 5 years. What exactly is going on?
It seems that Lucasfilm certainly has to be evaluating their hiring process, right? Because clearly they are not always picking people that can either execute the vision that Lucasfilm wants or work within the frameworks or constraints that Lucasfilm has for Star Wars. You know, some of the firings were kind of no-brainers. You know, In 2015, director Josh Trank, he was developing a Star Wars movie. Well, then his abysmal Fantastic Four came out, was a total bomb. Well, obviously that guy's not going to continue in the Star Wars universe. But then you have surprises. You have Phil Lord and Chris Miller fired from Solo while they're working on the project. You know, clearly whatever Lucasfilm president Kathleen Kennedy saw in them just didn't turn out to be what she wanted, you know, when she hired them. I think they think we want these fun, fresh voices, and then maybe it turns out that that's not quite what they want.
Well, so here we have Benioff and Weiss. They walk away from arguably the biggest film franchise in movie history to focus on a still undefined development deal with Netflix. What, if anything, does that say about the prestige and the power of the Star Wars brand moving forward?
Yeah, that's such a great point where, you know, maybe the brand is diminished somewhat, right? And it doesn't seem to feel like a creator-friendly brand in some ways. If you are seeing people fired or sidelined, you know, as happened in Rogue One, the director of Rogue One retained credit on that, but he was really, you know, Tony Gilroy was brought in and really is considered the author of that movie by many people. So when you see things like that happening, yeah, it doesn't seem like a creator-friendly environment.
And could it be also that you're talking about a franchise that's so huge that, you know, those involved are much more risk-averse than, say, George Lucas was in 1977 when the first Star Wars film came out?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it is interesting because Lucasfilm is bringing in Marvel Studios' Kevin Feige to work with Kathleen Kennedy on a, you know, still to be determined Star Wars movie. You know, Marvel is definitely a place where, you know, people complain, oh, Marvel movies are all the same, yet they are still really able to take some risks and have some filmmaker personalities, you know, kind of shown off in their movies. So it's tough because you don't want Star Wars to just be another Marvel, but at the same time, there might be some lessons there. I mean, Marvel has never had a bomb. They've had, you know, early on, maybe a few director switches here and there, but nothing on this level.
Aaron Couch is senior editor at The Hollywood Reporter. Aaron, thanks so much. It was a pleasure.
Thank you, Stephen.
Coming up on The Frame, photographer George Rodriguez has been shooting the disparate sides of L.A. for more than half a century. Welcome back to The Frame. I'm Stephen Cuevas in for John Horn. George Rodriguez has been taking photos for more than 50 years, capturing two very different sides of Los Angeles. There are his day job photos of film stars and teen heartthrobs from when he ran the photo lab at Columbia Pictures. He also shot a lot of prominent musicians for various magazines, including some of the very first images of hip-hop pioneers Ice Cube and Dr. Dre in the early days of the seminal rap group N.W.A., and there are also much more personal images, photographs that chronicle Rodriguez's interest in the Chicano protests and farmworker strikes of the 1960s and 70s, and of the South and East L.A. neighborhoods where he grew up. Rodriguez's work was published last year in a book titled Double Vision. Many of those images are now on view at the Vincent Price Art Museum in Monterey Park. I spoke with George Rodriguez last year when his book was published. He told me first about how he got into photography.
I remember the exact moment. I was fortunate to be in the district where Fremont High School, and they had an incredible photography course. They had turned out a mess of photojournalists. But anyway, I needed an elective, and some guy said, take photography. It's easy. So I did, and that's how it all began.
What did you like about it as a kid, though? I mean, some young people might not have the patience for it, especially when it comes to being in the dark room and developing and all that.
Well, that was kind of a perk, you know, the learning about photography. I needed a job. You know, I was 15 years old, and, you know, you hear your parents talking, and I just had to get out there and make a living. I mean, I had to help out. But it was the greatest thing that happened to me because it laid a foundation for my later going on to working in other labs, like in the best labs, like in the Hollywood area. And it's just something that happened, but it's what I knew.
Mm. I saw a quote, and I think you say something to the effect of the developing room became an escape. An escape from what?
Well, my school at that time was a bit rowdy, you know, and I could sought to be in a gang, whatever. I could have done that easily, but that wasn't me. You know, I mean, because of the neighborhood, I was thinking I got to get out of here. And I got a job on a steamship as a ship photographer. But then I got really homesick and came back and started working in photo labs. Mm. And that's a great foundation for taking photos because you know how film works.
Yeah. Now, there's one photo I want to ask you about here at the beginning, and that's the cover photo for Double Vision, the new book that covers about 50 years of your photographs. And that's a police officer is marching a young Latino protester, presumably, along the sidewalk. The photo really has this sense of movement. It looks like he's hustling him up the sidewalk very fast.
That's what you call a bum's rush.
Yeah.
You know,
he has him from behind and he's...
Yeah, and he's pushing him along the sidewalk. And
what was going on that day?
Well, that was when I worked at Columbia in the photo lab during my lunch hours. If there was something going on, like the walkouts at the high schools.
1970, was, we're talking about.
Exactly, 1970, I would take off and go down there and shoot what I could.
We are a bronze people with a bronze culture.
The police had a field day. Those were high school kids, and but they were literally hitting them with batons, you know, and roughing them up. And that's not why I was there, but I was fortunate to be able to document that part of the Chicano experience.
What were you trying to expose in these communities to people who maybe never went into South Central Los Angeles?
Well, maybe how authority treated the community. That line in the Buffalo Springfield song, you know, what a field day for the heat. That's what it was like.
What a field day for the heat. A thousand people in the street.
You know, being beaten with batons and thrown in the back of police cars. And
would you have been out there on the streets during the times of the demonstrations, even if you weren't a photographer?
Oh, for sure. I'm influenced very much by my father. You know, he's born in Mexico City, and he was like a hardcore Mexicano. You know, they just, they know who they are, and I think I developed that.
What were your reasons for wanting to be there to document these events? Well, because you weren't shooting for anyone specifically when it came to these photos.
No, not that. I was, I'm a big fan of Life magazine photographers. They were my idols, and I saw what they did with the African-American movement, and I assume I want to do the same thing for the Chicano movement when it began. That's what I was going to do. I'm going to document all these marches and events and do a book. Originally, it was going to be titled Así Es Mi Raza, which more or less translates to that's the way we are. But then in meeting Josh Kuhn, the writer, we met because he was curating a show for the Grammy Museum, and he came into my studio to look at some rock and roll stuff. And then he asked if I'd be interested in doing a book. And I remember telling him, I am doing a book, but my version was just of the Mexican-American experience. But then he and like other people, I said, no, it's bigger than that because you worked in so many areas.
We're talking to photographer George Rodriguez about his new book and exhibit called Double Vision. The title of the retrospective of your work refers to the process of double exposing film. So you superimpose one image on top of another.
The title talks about how I worked in so many areas, like
right.
in Hollywood and the recording industry. And in doing this book, I realized I've had so many did-that-really-happen moments, like, you know, being in the room that Cesar Chavez fasted in, looking at proof sheets with Jim Morrison.
So what's the story with Jim Morrison, you know, late lead vocalist of The Doors?
Like I say, I managed the photo lab at Columbia, so after work, I could stay and work on my own thing. So I remember shooting The Doors at the Whiskey A Go-Go. When they started, he wore like these long-sleeved white dress shirts, and I thought that was amazing or different for a rock and roller. He's just a regular guy. Mm-hmm. You know, I shot the first Jackson 5 liner photos, and again, meeting like a 12-year-old Michael Jackson. Just a great kid, just a, you know, full of life.
Well, I think in some cases, like in the Jackson 5 or Michael Jackson, you got to know them a little bit too. And there's in fact, there's one photo of you shooting baskets with members, with some of the brothers at their house in Encino.
Yeah, my brother, that's my brother Rudy Rodriguez, and he would often come to help me on shoots. And Yeah, so he's playing basketball. Oh, with him.
That's him playing basketball.
Yes, When Michael realized we were brothers, he asked me who could beat up who. And here we are in our 30s, you know, but that's kind of a very, you know, a kid question.
You had the opportunity to embed with and shoot Cesar Chavez many times. How aware was he of the camera and the importance of kind of his public image and publicity, if you will?
The times I was around him, he was busy. You know, this was during the Great Boycott. So he always had people around him. He wasn't like one guy by himself. He just always had two or three or four assistants.
Yeah.
You know, that one picture I have of Caesar with the Kennedy banner behind him, I recall just pulling him aside and having him stand there because I thought the lighting was in that spot was really good. And he is, you know, very, very cooperative, but busy. When you're around somebody like that, you know something's going on. But you know that that individual is not into it for himself. He's into it to help people.
Also, you got to know a little bit in Photograph NWA and the individual members of NWA. And again, I see those photos as a moment when the two worlds kind of collapse in on each other in a good way, because these guys are coming from the streets, and you're photographing them as they're blossoming into kind of rock stars in their own right.
Yeah, that was like in 90, 91. The rumors on these guys were that they were very special. So I had a tagger make me a background so we could use it to shoot them. They were, I mean, again, in a different way, you're in the presence of somebody that you know they're different. You know you don't want to, like, step on their values because this is the real deal.
But you understood where they were coming from.
Absolutely, though. Absolutely. Yeah. And a lot of people, I think, when they heard the music, they think it's clever and, you know, catchy, but they don't realize the message. The first time I shot him, Easy gave me some cassette. Easy E.
Yeah.
He gave me four cassettes, and I played one on the way home, and I couldn't believe it. I mean, I had never, ever heard anything like that. It was straight out of Compton, and I was just amazed. And they're my favorite rap band. You know, that's the only rap music I play in my car, that cassette, because I like it.
So you still have a studio in downtown on Spring Street and in Pico Rivera at your home. You also work out of your home. So what's a work day like these days for you?
These days, it's, dealing with this book, doing research. But I am a source for other people doing books. If your book has to do with rock and roll or even Chicano history, then I'm a source for those folks that need photographs.
You still shoot?
Oh, I do every day, yeah. But only because I have my camera with me. You know, I don't, it's not on the job, but I may be retired. I don't know. I still have my studio.
George, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Oh, thank you so much.
George Rodriguez's Double Vision can be seen at the Vincent Price Art Museum on the campus of Cal State LA through next February. Coming up, the singer Sancha has had to walk a fine line inside her culture.
I kind of ran away, but I ended up landing in the farm that my mom grew up with. You know, I'm here coming from this queer scene.
Stay tuned for more of The Frame. Welcome back to The Frame. I'm Stephen Cuevas sitting in for John Horn. The LA-based singer Sancha has a complicated relationship with her faith. She grew up Catholic in San Jose, but her experiences singing in church didn't exactly match up with her queer identity. She'd eventually find a more welcoming community in the Bay Area punk scene. On her album Capricho del Diablo, The Devil's Whim, her music is a DIY take on cumbia rhythms mixed with church harmonies and ranchera melodies. Her lyrics are personal stories interwoven with Catholic symbolism.
Hi, my name is Sancha. I'm a singer, I'm a songwriter, and a performer. I started singing in the church choir when I was 12. The music that I liked the most was always like this Lent season music that was very about like desperation, like I have no hope, like I don't know where I'm going because I'm about to die kind of thing. But my life really changed when I met my drag mother in San Francisco. I met her at a bar. And we just danced all night. And then my drag mother, her name is Persia, she asked me to sing at her art opening. And since then, I've been performing like every weekend. The name Sancha, it means mistress. But I was thinking about, you know, like more in religious terms, where like a saint, San Francisco, San Jose, is kind of a side piece, and it kind of shows how polytheistic the Catholic Mexican religion is. So this album was a reflection on religion, on not having religion, on what spirituality looks outside of anything even written, and something more felt. Me Demandó is actually the first song that I wrote for the album, but I also at that time was singing on the streets in Mexico City, and how I at times would have to project to like big restaurants or even to places like taco stands that were all outside, and was thinking of how free I felt when like I was at those like really high belty noises, and how like liberating that felt. And it's mostly because of the freedom that I felt at that time, like being really distraught and hurt and being like, no, I'm going to take this energy and create something else that channels my hurt and my pain. Me demandó mi salvador means my savior sued me. So this song is specifically about this relationship that I had with somebody that was very like mentor, and about him telling me that, you know, I'm this special thing, but it's like something he wanted to consume and for his consumption. And once it didn't fit into that, then he wanted to sue me. He was like, you owe me your soul. And I worked a party for him. It's very like goth themed and very like S&M. So when he told me that, I was like, oh, he really thinks he's the devil. And for me, like, playing around with this devil and savior theme has switched back and forth, especially on this album. And the way, like, I've heard Chavela Vargas sing or Lola Beltrán, you almost hear them crying on every track. I did go to Mexico. I kind of ran away. But I ended up landing in the farm that my mom grew up with. So I have an aunt that lives there. My mom is one of 12 children. And so the aunt that's living there is the one aunt that did not get married or did not cross the border to come to the United States. So I landed with her in this family farm. You know, I'm here coming from this queer scene and coming here with like purple hair, shaved eyebrows, long black dresses. And my aunt here, like as soon as I land, she's like, oh, I'm following the Virgen around to different farms. And they were praying like 3 to 4 rosaries every night and then having a service at every farm. And I'm over here like looking like the craziest witch lady alien that these kids have ever seen, you know? Like, oh, these people in like rural whatever, they don't understand me. I'm queer and I'm this and that. And like, we actually had really beautiful conversations about a lot of things. And I opened up to her a lot and she opened up to me a lot. I was like my aunt who lives in rural wherever the, you know, is way more compassionate than a lot of queer people that I've dealt with in places that are supposed to be woke. Thank you, everybody, for being here tonight. Dicen que por las noches no más se le iba. In LA, a lot of my crowd is people and Latinx people who also grew up with religion being, you know, stuffed down their throat, and who also didn't fit in, who feel like aliens in their families, but also we're at odds with ourselves, you know? Like, I love my mom, but I can't, you know, tell her a lot of things. And I think a lot of people who come to my shows and things like that also feel that way.
Sancha performs November 1st as part of a free Day of the Dead concert at Grand Park in downtown L.A. That story was produced by The Frame's Jonathan Shiflett. And that's all for today. Don't forget, you can keep up with The Frame on Twitter and Facebook and subscribe to our weekly newsletter, why don't you? It goes out every Thursday. Sign up at theframe.org. I'm Stephen Cuevas. Thanks for listening. We're back here tomorrow.